Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning. Last week, a senior Pentagon official authorized a new trial for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four others accused of orchestrating the September 11, 2001 attacks. An arraignment will be held at the military prison at Guantanamo Bay next month. All five men were held in secret CIA custody at prisons overseas before they were transferred to Guantanamo in September of 2006. Prosecutors cannot use as evidence any statement that resulted from torture or cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. Attorneys for the men are likely to make their treatment a central part of any defense against the death penalty. Military missions, as you may recall, were set up to achieve easy convictions and to hide the reality of torture. Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times in 1 month alone. And we'll be talking about torture, about the use, widespread use of torture, about military commissions and Guantanamo and related issues this hour of the program. Marjorie Cohn is our guest. She's going to be in Milwaukee later this week. She is a professor of law at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, immediate past president of the National Lawyers Guild. She lectures throughout the world on international human rights and U.S. foreign policy. She's a news consultant for CBS News and a legal analyst for Court TV, and she provides legal and political commentary on BBC, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, NPR, Air America, and other places. She has been a criminal defense attorney at the trial and appellate levels, and she is the author, her latest book, now out in paperback, The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. Our phone number, as we talk about this serious topic, our number one of our show is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Marjorie Cohn, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tell me first, give me an idea of who is at Guantanamo at this point in time and why these people have been held there for so many years.
There are a little over 100 detainees still held at Guantanamo, and most of them have been cleared for release, but the United States military can't find anywhere to send them. Many are Yemeni, and there's a fear that if they go back to Yemen that they will be subjected to torture or even death. Now, my understanding is that just in the last day or two, there are negotiations with the Yemeni government for their return, but I don't know what's going to come of that. There are people, very, very few, who the U.S. military wants to put on trial, and the Obama administration wanted to bring them into the United States and put them on trial in U.S. federal courts, which since 9/11 and even before have proved very effective in handling cases involving allegations of terrorism. We have the Classified Information Procedures Act, which can protect classified information. Judges and prosecutors in the federal system agree that it is a very good system. Many people have been convicted of terrorism crimes. And yet, when the Republicans in Congress use this as a political football, passing, urging, and getting legislation through, which Democrats agreed to forbid any transfer of people to the United States for trial so that they all have to be tried at Guantanamo and military commissions, then Obama backed down. And in a way, he was forced to back down. They forced his hand. So what you just mentioned about these men who are going to face trial in the military commissions is a different situation than originally when Obama had intended to send them to, I think it was New York, and then for trial in federal court, and then I believe it was the mayor of New York made a big fuss over it.
I remember that.
Yeah. So they're going to be tried in the military commissions and not in U.S. federal courts. And of course, in the military commissions, There is not a public trial right. There are many more limitations on due process. Hearsay evidence is admissible. The detainee can't see all the all the evidence against him, and they can even get the death penalty in a proceeding which does not afford full due process.
Now, the men who are going to be on trial were kept in secret CIA prisons for a number of years before they went to Guantanamo?
Yes. The men who are set to be tried in the military commission, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and five other men, were kept in what are called the CIA black sites during the Bush administration, which are secret prisons where the International Committee of the Red Cross had no access. And under the Geneva Conventions, the International Committee of the Red Cross is the official organization that must have, it's mandatory, that they have access to all prisoners anywhere in the world. And they maintain confidentiality about what they see, but they are a watchdog agency to make sure that prisoners are treated humanely, because under the Geneva Conventions, there are no gaps. There is, whether someone is a prisoner of war, a member of Al-Qaeda, Taliban, or whatever, there is no right under the Geneva Conventions to treat someone with torture and cruel treatment. It is absolutely forbidden. And we have two other treaties. The United States has ratified the Convention Against Torture and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which also forbid torture and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment in all instances. When the United States ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which says treaties shall be the supreme law of the land. So it's not just international obligations we have, it's actually domestic obligations as well, never to torture anyone.
So how much do we know about what happened in those black sites?
Well, there have not been official reports released, but men who have been held there have reported severe torture. And we do know that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times, and Abu Zubaydah, another alleged Al-Qaeda official, was waterboarded 83 times. Waterboarding is, well, it has long been considered torture under U.S. law. The United States tried, convicted, and hung Japanese lawyers for waterboarding as torture after World War II. And yet, in the memos, the so-called torture memos by the Bush administration lawyers, referred to by Richard Falk in one of the chapters in the United States in Torture as legal mercenaries, who basically, according to Philippe Sands, who also wrote a chapter, they gave Bush legal cover to torture and abuse people. And so justified waterboarding. They said it was justified. Since the Bush stepped down from power, since his regime has ended, Bush, Cheney, and John Yoo have all said, yes, we participated in the decision to authorize waterboarding, and we would do it again. Now, waterboarding constitutes torture. And torture is considered a war crime under the U.S. War Crimes Act. And so what Bush, Cheney, and John Yoo have done is to admit the commission of war crimes. They have admitted that they are war criminals. Now, whether they will ever be brought to justice for their war crimes is another issue.
And what does that treatment, that kind of torture, do to in a military tribunal? Does it render what they have to say ineffective? Can you deliberate on what they have to say, or can that be admissible or not in a tribunal?
Well, under the military, what happened was that in November of 2001, Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, his Secretary of Defense, set up the first military commissions. And the Supreme Court basically held that those military commissions were unconstitutional because they didn't even have the minimum due process as required by the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the Geneva Conventions. So Bush rammed through Congress a new and improved Military Commissions Act in 2009, which is slightly better than the old one, but still does not afford adequate due process. And under the new Military Commissions Act, evidence that has been obtained by torture or cruel treatment is not admissible. But if it was obtained before December of 2005, which is when the Detainee Treatment Act came into law, that was the John McCain amendment that we heard about, which extended the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment to anywhere in the world. In other words, the United States can't not only can't torture anyone anywhere in the world, but also can't engage in cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. And so if the cruel treatment happened before December of 2005, then not torture, but short of torture, it might be admissible. And so we have not really seen, of course, these trials are not open to the public, but we have not really seen them in action yet, so we don't know how it's going to work.
Marjorie, do you believe that torture can ever give valuable information?
I can't say whether it can ever give valuable information, but I do know that interrogators agree that torture is not generally effective to get intelligence. Glenn Carl, who supervised the 2002 interrogation of a high-level detainee for the CIA, told the New York Times that coercive techniques didn't provide useful, meaningful, trustworthy information. Ali Soufan, who interrogated Abu Zubaydah, testified before Congress that harsh interrogation techniques are ineffective, slow, unreliable, and as a result, harmful to our efforts to defeat al-Qaeda. And he says, Ali Soufan, that any useful information that Zubaydah provided happened before these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques were utilized. That's a euphemism for terrorism. And then Matthew Alexander, a former senior military interrogator who supervised or conducted 1,300 interrogations in Iraq, which led to the capture of several al-Qaeda leaders, said, "I think that without a doubt, torture and enhanced interrogation techniques slowed down the hunt for bin Laden." A 2006 study by the National Defense Intelligence College found that traditional rapport-building interrogation techniques are extremely effective, even with the most hardened detainees, but coercive tactics create resistance and resentment. Now, when I testified in 2008 before the House Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties about Bush administration policy, one of the Republican congressmen asked me how I would fashion an interrogation statute. And I replied that it would require humane, kind, respectful treatment to develop trust. That Republican congressman and another started snickering and thought that was funny until Professor Philippe Sands, I said, who also wrote a chapter in the book, who was testifying with me on the same panel, said that I was correct, that the British got much better information, better intelligence from the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, when they used humane techniques.
So why did they chuckle at you and they didn't at him?
Well, that's a good question. I think it was hard to argue with the evidence that he presented and the fact that he had corroborated what I said. And maybe because he was a man, I don't know. But I found it quite interesting.
Why is it that all of these people were not brought to trial a long time ago?
Well, I probably for a number of reasons. The overwhelming majority of men who were held at Guantanamo were innocent of any terrorism-related activity. Many had been picked up by mistake or picked up for bounty, $3,000 a head, $5,000 a head by the Northern Alliance, tribal leaders in Afghanistan and Pakistan and turned over to the U.S. military, who then flew them to Guantanamo. So many were there by mistake, and so there was no probable cause to try them for any crimes. Many had been tortured or severely abused, and evidently the military prosecutors thought that they might have trouble getting a conviction, since that would likely come out that they had been tortured. And also the politics that I described about where to try them, and the fact that the military commissions were ruled unconstitutional, and it wasn't until 2009 that the Military Commissions Act was revamped. But again, there have been very few cases that have gone through. I think the first case was a plea bargain for David Hicks, who is an Australian, who was allowed to plead guilty to a misdemeanor that I got him, I think, about 8 months and in prison, and he was released with credit for time served and sent back to Australia. So these vicious terrorists that we've been told about who are being held in Guantanamo, it just really has not panned out. Now, I'm not saying that that there might not be people who should be tried for war crimes in Guantanamo, but by all accounts of people who are well respected in the legal field and who have had experience in the legal system, such as judges and prosecutors in the federal courts, as I mentioned, say that it would be much more effective, and there would be accountability. There would be, you know, trials are open in this country. The public would be able to see that justice was being done if they were brought and tried in federal court.
And do we know, do we keep track of what happened to all of those innocent people when they were sent wherever they were sent, home?
Yes, I think the Center for Constitutional Rights has an idea about who has been there and where they were sent. I don't have that list, but I and I'm not sure. Maybe they don't know all of the people. I mean, there's been an awful lot of secrecy during the Bush administration and still continuing into the Obama administration. Secrecy is kind of a hallmark of the so-called war on terror, and you know, without minimizing the tragedy of the horrific attacks on September 11th, I have to say that this term war on terror, which was coined during the Bush administration, we don't hear it quite as much in the Obama administration, but they're still pursuing a lot of the same policies. War on terror is a misnomer, because terrorism is a tactic. It's not an enemy, and you don't declare war on a tactic. And yet, under the guise of this so-called war on terror, the Constitution was shredded during the Bush administration, so much so that four times the Supreme Court, a conservative Supreme Court, slapped them down and said, no, you can't deny habeas corpus to people at Guantanamo. Your military commissions violate the U.S. and international law, et cetera. So I think that we have to be very, very careful about succumbing to the mainstream media when they quote uncritically the administration, you know, that says take it at face value that we're protecting you, we're keeping you safe, and all of these things are necessary. Spying, domestic surveillance, data mining, killing U.S. citizens, holding people indefinitely for the rest of their lives. All of these things are necessary to keep you safe, and then we salute and march and take it on faith that they know better. But in a democracy, it is the duty of citizens to question the governmental policies, especially when the government is doing things in their name, in our name, that are illegal and that make us that are not only illegal and immoral and ineffective, and I'm talking now about torture and cruel treatment, but also that make us less safe. There have been reports, especially there's one recently from someone in Afghanistan. He's an interrogator currently serving in Afghanistan. This is very interesting. And he told Forbes magazine, I cannot even count the amount of times that I personally have come face to face with detainees who told me they were primarily motivated to do what they did because of hearing we committed torture. Torture committed by Americans in the past continues to kill Americans today. And former Navy Council General Counsel Alberto Mora testified before Congress that the two most effective recruiting tools for those who would harm our soldiers in Iraq were Abu Ghraib, the photographs, at Guantanamo. You know, when people see the U.S. government torturing detainees from their countries, they resent us even more. So the torture makes us less safe, not more.
You, of course, read extensively, and the focus of the book is the Bush torture policy. But you also take on the Obama administration, saying that they say they don't engage in torture, but if the officials, lawyers, and operatives from the Bush administration who ordered, committed, aided, and abetted torture are not held legally accountable, what will prevent the next administration from authorizing cruel treatment?
Absolutely. And I have to say that I served on a panel in Vienna recently with Manfred Novak, who was the former UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. And he told me that he had been getting almost daily reports from the Bush administration during the Bush administration about torture, and those he was not getting those during the Obama administration, but he was very concerned that Obama had turned over some 9,000 prisoners to the Iraqi government, knowing that that they would be tortured. I mean, one of the things that the documents that were leaked to WikiLeaks showed was that there was torture going on in the Iraqi prisons, and Manfred Novak was also very concerned that the Obama administration has refused to bring the Bush officials and torturers to justice. And I want to talk about that, but I also want to mention a worrisome development, which is that David Petraeus was being questioned by Congress at his confirmation hearing to become the new CIA director, and he told Congress, Petraeus, that there might be circumstances in which a return to enhanced interrogation is warranted. That means that there could be torture that continues during the Obama administration. This is a very startling development. What has happened, first of all, the Constitution has what is called the Take Care Clause, which requires that the president take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And yet Obama has said, well, nobody's above the law, but I want to look forward, not backward. And his Justice Department, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, proclaimed last June that basically it intends to grant a free pass to the Bush officials and their lawyers who constructed the regime of torture and abuse. Eric Holder said his office will investigate only two instances of detainee mistreatment. And Holder said the department has determined that an expanded criminal investigation of the remaining matters, that means the thousands of people who have been tortured, the remaining matters is not warranted. Now, both of the incidents that Holder has agreed to investigate involved egregious treatment, and both resulted in death. And they should be investigated and those responsible punished in accordance with the law. But this investigation must have a much broader scope, since more than 100 detainees have died in custody, many from torture, and untold numbers subjected to torture and cruel treatment in violation of our laws. General Barry McCaffrey said, "We tortured people unmercifully. We probably murdered dozens of them during the course of that, both the armed forces and the CIA. And yet they will not be brought to justice in this country." Now, that does not mean that they will never be brought to justice, because under the very well-established doctrine of universal jurisdiction, they might be held accountable. Excuse me. Universal jurisdiction is a theory that many countries, including Israel and the United States, have used to bring foreign nationals to justice for war crimes, crimes against humanity. They are thought to be so atrocious that they're crimes against all people. And the problem is, during the Bush administration, there were some countries who were investigating under universal jurisdiction, bringing some Bush officials to trial for war crimes, such as Donald Rumsfeld for torture. But Belgium had an investigation pending against Donald Rumsfeld. But the Bush administration threatened Belgium and said, if you don't drop this investigation against Donald Rumsfeld, we're going to arrange to pull the headquarters of NATO out of Brussels.
Oh, really? I
Belgium
hadn't heard
back
that.
Down. Yeah, huh. It was a threat. It was a threat. There were a few delicious months in there that Rumsfeld was afraid to travel abroad, but then they dropped the investigation. And during the Obama administration, there were six of the Bush torture lawyers, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, et cetera, who were being investigated in Spain for their participation in the torture regime. They received reportedly a lot of political pressure from the Obama administration and eventually dropped that investigation. So the United States wields great power, a lot of clout on the world scene. We know that, but it may be down the line at some point that that these war criminals will be held accountable.
Marjorie Cohn, our guest this hour. We're going to welcome phone calls. She is the author of The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. She's written a number of other books as well. She's an author, law professor, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and she's going to be speaking in Milwaukee this coming Thursday at 7:30 at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Union, Room 280. It's free and open to the public if you want to carry on this conversation. And if you'd like to join us, we will be taking your phone calls momentarily. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls with Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I called with a question, but I'd also like to put in a comment based on something that the your guest has said while I was waiting online. I grew up in Louisiana, and some friends of our family, you know, lifelong friends of our family, are German, and he was a prisoner of war during there was a prison camp in Louisiana during World War II, and he was a German prisoner of war here, and he said that he was so impressed with how forced labor, basically. They were building roads and various other infrastructure projects, but he says they were treated very humanely. They were fed well, they got medical care, they were well clothed, as soon as he was released from the prison after World War II ended, he applied to stay in the United States, and he was granted, and he became a U.S. citizen, and his great-grandchildren are Americans, and something has definitely gone wrong. And as for the question, it's clear that the guest has a very passionate and, I think, well-reasoned point of view, and which I agree with, by the way. I think this is a terrible stain on our history, and I think history is going to judge us very harshly for how we've conducted ourselves during this war. But clearly, there must be legal people of fairly with nice, expensive Harvard law degrees who would argue very passionately in defense of what the Bush administration and perhaps the Obama administration has done vis-a-vis torture.
Marjorie.
Yes, Bill, thank you for that question. And my father, who was a captain in World War II, also reported the same thing, that they treated their prisoners very humanely. When he's heard me talk, he can't believe what the Bush administration did. It's interesting you ask this question, because just a few days ago, a memo became public that had been suppressed by the Bush administration that shows that there was real debate within the Bush administration about the legality of these tactics of torture and cruel treatment. In 2006, Philip Zelikow, who was counselor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in the State Department, wrote a memo opposing the Bush administration's torture practices. And according to Zelikow, quote, "My colleagues were entitled to ignore my views. They did more than that. The White House attempted to collect and destroy all copies of my memo. I expect that one or two are still at least in the State Department's archives," unquote. Well, it turns out that there was one copy, and it was declassified in response to a Freedom of Information Act request by the National Security Archive. And what he says is that the Convention Against Torture and the Constitution's prohibitions against cruel and unusual punishment do apply. In other words, would prevent the CIA's use of waterboarding walling, which is when you throw somebody into a wall, dousing, that's when you throw freezing cold water on them, stress positions, when you hang someone from the ceiling or tether them to the floor, and cramped confinement, putting people in small boxes, sometimes with insects. And Zelikow said, we are aware of any precedent in World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, or any subsequent conflict for authorized systematic interrogation practices similar to those in question here, even when the prisoners were presumed to be unlawful combatants. So there was, and I wrote a Law Review article about this that was just published in the Seattle Journal of Social Justice, about how it is unethical at least and criminal at best for lawyers to advise the president on how to basically commit war crimes and get away with it. They had a predetermined result that the Bush administration wanted. They wanted to be able to torture these people, and they said, give me the, in Philippe Sand's words, legal cover to do it. And yes, there were top minds. John Yoo, who is brilliant, he is teaching, he's a distinguished professor of law at Berkeley Law School, who provided that information. Now, I'm very proud to say that my organization, the National Lawyers Guild, was one of the first to call for not just the investigation and prosecution of John Yoo, but also his firing from a tenured position at Berkeley Law School. And some of my colleagues in the Legal Academy said, oh, no, that's protected by academic freedom. Academic freedom protects professors who want to say any kind of cockamamie thing in the classroom or write law review articles about unorthodox theories or write books, scholarly articles, etc. But when they start to advise the president on how to commit war crimes and get away with it, that crosses the line. And my understanding is that John Yoo, he and Jay Bybee, who was rewarded with a lifetime appointment on the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, were the primary authors of the most heinous torture memos that redefined torture so badly that they narrowed the definition of torture. You have to practically kill someone for it to amount to torture. They concocted defenses for torture, even though our law is clear. There's never, ever, even in the state of war, any justification for torture. And John Yoo now teaches his classes at Berkeley Law School in an undisclosed location, so that if you want to take his class, you have to swear to secrecy.
Really? Interesting. Yes. Bill, thanks for the call. Tom in Wausau, hi.
Good morning. What an excellent program. First of all, not trying to get off topic or anything, but this discussion and this practice, this policy kind of reminds me, and I am a veteran, reminds me of a Van Halen video from years ago where there was a couple of cartoon stick figures that says, right now, our country is doing things that other countries are supposed to do. And it has demeaned us in such a way, particularly to us veterans. I just can't believe that we found ourselves, and at this point, or that we have found ourselves at that point, and this individual cases are going to occur, whether it's in a precinct in New York or whether it's, you know, offshore somewhere. Stuff happens. But to have it as a policy, And at the highest levels of our government, the highest, is so embarrassing. And what would the guest suggest that we do as, you know, quote unquote normal citizens to try to petition to get some of these things taken care of? It really is a black eye. I've never been more disappointed in my country than when these things have come to light. So.
Professor Cohn.
Yes, Tom. Thank you for that very important question. I think that the first thing we have to do is educate ourselves about what's really happening, because if we look at the mainstream media, the corporate media, we are going to, by and large, get the party line. Sometimes we see a bit of criticism, but most of the criticism, most of the facts that you're going to get, you have to dig for them. You have to listen to programs like this. You have to read articles by people such as myself who write on Counterpunch, Common Dreams, Truth Out, Alternet, you know, these outlets. You can look at my website, MarjorieCohn.com, which has a lot of useful research about these topics. And And so once we educate ourselves and pay attention to the news and see what's happening, then it is our duty to speak out, and to speak out in both individually and collectively. And that means it's not hard to get a letter to the editor published in your local newspaper. If you see an article or you see an editorial, if you gear it to that and respond to that and keep it under 150 words and keep it, you know, very succinct, it is not hard to get letters to the editor published. And even if your letter doesn't get published, they count letters, so that if there are 10 letters on one topic, that might move them to publish one letter on that topic, so you might help others get published. If you're so moved, you can write op-eds in the newspaper or on these websites, on blogs. Also, it's very important to pressure Congress and the White House, because they do respond to political pressure, which means writing letters, writing emails, phone calls to your congresspersons, to the White House, demonstrating, getting together for collective action with other like-minded people. The Occupy movement, I think, is one of the most promising developments in our country since I was part of the anti-Vietnam War movement many, many years ago. Judging from an editorial in the New York Times yesterday, it looks like the two conventions, the Republican and Democratic conventions, they're going to put in place policies that are going to discourage Occupy demonstrations, and we should be prepared for that. But I think that it's very, very important, wherever you are, regardless of where you live, to get together with other like-minded folks in teach-ins, in demonstrations, educate yourselves, speak out, and be heard. It's the only way that things will ever change.
Marjorie, I've always wondered, when you look at prominent politicians right now, you'd be hard-pressed to find any who experience torture the way that John McCain did. And John McCain has been very upfront about saying torture doesn't work. Why wasn't his voice heard more by the administration that fashioned the torture memo, when he was the voice who you needed to listen to? Seriously, don't you think?
Well, I think that's a good point. I mean, John Yoo is quite conservative, but he was tortured in Vietnam, and he has been very outspoken. The Detainee Treatment Act has the so-called McCain Amendment, which extends U.S. The prohibition against the United States engaging in cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment anywhere in the world. Also, after Osama bin Laden was executed by the Obama administration, people like John Yoo said, "Oh wow, here, you know, Bush is vindicated. Torture worked." John Yoo wrote in the Wall Street Journal that the kill vindicates the Bush administration, whose intelligence architecture marked the path to bin Laden's door. Well, that wasn't true, and in fact, John McCain declared in a speech on the Senate floor that it was not torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of detainees that got us the major leads that ultimately enabled our intelligence community to find Osama bin Laden. McCain quoted then-CIA Director Leon Panetta, who said that the courier who ultimately led us to bin Laden came from a detainee held in another country who we believe was not tortured. None of the three detainees who were waterboarded provided the real name of that courier. And then McCain said, in fact, the use of enhanced interrogation techniques on colleague Sheikh Mohammed produced false and misleading information. So it is true that that there were a few members of Congress on the Senate and House Intelligence Committees who were briefed on the program of torture and abuse and who did not object. I don't think that McCain was one of them, if I'm not mistaken. And John McCain certainly has played, I think, an important role in opposing an official policy of torture.
Thanks, Tom, for the call. Mike in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, I've been listening to your guest with a lot of interest, and I'm sure she and I could probably not agree to anything. However, we can probably agree to one thing. There's probably a huge difference between the Bush and the Obama administration, politically, ideologically, et cetera. And so doesn't it strike her odd that two administrations are basically following the same path and doing basically the same thing?
Marjorie.
That's a good question. And I, from reading books about the Obama administration and articles, the only thing I can figure is that Obama has kept some of the Bush people in his, Robert Gates, for example, was his in his cabinet as the Secretary of Defense. And so a lot of the policies, there has been a very smooth transition. The Obama administration is, concerned, as was the Bush administration, about preventing another terrorist attack. And so has, you know, in some ways, Obama has gone even beyond the Bush administration in his use of unmanned CIA drones, which basically assassinate people indiscriminately. Many civilians have died in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. The indefinite detention policy, he has really taken that much further, the assassination of U.S. citizens. and these are things that we should speak out against. My feeling is that the way to prevent terrorism is not to shred the Constitution and lock people up forever and kill civilians. I don't think that that makes us any safer. I think that if we really want to be safe from terrorism, it's a much, much taller order. We need to completely reassess our foreign policy. What do we do? What is it about U.S. policy that moved 19 men to blow themselves up, commit suicide, and take 3,000 innocents with them? It was not our democracy. That is not why people kill themselves. It has to do with the United States invading other countries and killing their people and occupying their lands and torturing their people and killing their civilians. And there has been a history of this that goes back before Bush and certainly before Obama. But they have continued this policy. Yes, Obama has taken credit for ending U.S. military involvement in Iraq, but he tried to extend it up until the last minute, and the reason that it wasn't extended was because the Iraqi government refused to grant immunity, criminal and civil immunity, to U.S. soldiers for crimes after seeing the WikiLeaks videos showing the commission of war crimes against Iraqis. But Obama has certainly continued and even in some ways stepped up U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan. There is a very disturbing thing going on right now that we should all be really, really worried about, and that is militaristic talk from the Obama administration about attacking Iran in support of our very close ally, Israel. There are negotiations coming up over Iran's nuclear program this weekend, and the UN International Atomic Energy Agency and the National Intelligence Estimate of 16 top intelligence groups in the United States are unanimous that there is no evidence that Iran is developing nuclear weapons, and Iran has a right under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to develop nuclear power for peaceful purposes. And there's a negotiation coming up this weekend, and the Obama administration is going into this with incredibly high demands, saying this is your last chance. You either shut down this power plant that is, you know, in this nuclear plant in the side of a mountain, and send your stop enriching uranium and send it out of the country, or the implication is you're going to be invaded, and Obama talks about, well, we're not going to pursue a policy of containment against Iran, which is what we did with the Soviet Union that had unknown numbers of, you know, hundreds or thousands of nuclear weapons. We're going to act militarily to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. Well, there's nothing in the UN Charter or in any of our laws that allow an attack, a military attack on another country to prevent some hypothetical thing in the future.
We need to pause for a moment, Marjorie. Marjorie Cohn is our guest, professor of law, Thomas Jefferson School of Law, editor of the United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. She's going to be in Milwaukee this coming Thursday, April 12 at 7:30 at the UW-Milwaukee Union. We'll take more phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our two of our program this Tuesday, the author of Tutankhamun, The Search for an Egyptian King. Our guest is an Egyptologist who teaches at Liverpool University and also at the Center for Biomedical Egyptology at the University of Manchester. It's a fascinating book, and King Tut continues to fascinate us. That will be hour two. Here's an email that has come in, Marjorie Cohn, from Tom from Washburn, who asks, we have heard stories that Bush administration officials cited the popular television show 24 as proof that torture works. Any truth in that?
The show 24, which is no longer on, was on Fox, and it was produced evidently by people close to the Bush administration to convince Americans that we knew who the terrorist was, who knows where the ticking time bomb is, and if we torture him, he'll tell us and we'll save millions of lives. I mean, that's the scenario. One of the chapters in The United States in Torture is written by a philosopher. It's an interdisciplinary anthology, and there's one by a philosopher, John Lango, who basically calls this so-called ticking time bomb scenario a fantasy. There's no guarantee that we'll ever know who the terrorist is who knows where the ticking time bomb is, and that torturing him will lead us to the bomb and save millions of lives. He says terrorism can never warrant terroristic torment. And he also cites the torture convention, which we've ratified, which says no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification for torture. I agree with John Lango, Professor Lango. It is a fantasy, and it is a scenario that was concocted by the Bush administration to try to convince people that that torture was okay.
Matt in Wisconsin Rapids, hi.
Hi, I was just listening to the program, and I agree with your guest for the most part. However, I'm curious why more attention is not being given to the indefinite detention clause of the most previous NDAA, American Defense Authorization Act.
All right, well, your phone line is lousy. The indefinite detention clause, Marjorie?
Yes, I think I mentioned that this was part of the National Defense Authorization Act that Obama signed on New Year's Eve, and he did attach a signing statement saying, limiting his use of it. but still, it is a very, very startling development. It violates a treaty that we've ratified, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which forbids arbitrary detention. And Matt is right. Indefinite detention means that somebody could be held the rest of their lives without any criminal charges being brought against them. This is not what the United States of America should be about, or any other country for that matter. It's outrageous, quite frankly, and Obama could have refused. He could have vetoed that legislation until that provision was removed. He chose to kind of take a middle ground, but it's there. It's there for other presidents to use as well in the future, and it is not something that belongs in U.S. law. In fact, it violates our international obligations.
One more call. We only have a minute left. Art in Milwaukee. Hi.
Marjorie, I know you don't have much time, and you'll probably expand on this at your talk Thursday night in the UWM Union, but could you comment on the case of Bradley Manning and his treatment compared to those people in Iraq who committed war crimes?
Yes. In fact, Bradley Manning is accused of leaking videos that show evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq. He has been held for 20 months in military custody. During the first 8 months, he was kept in solitary confinement in a military brig. And solitary confinement is, as described in one of the chapters in my book, can amount to torture. It can lead to hallucinations, suicide, catatonia. He was stripped naked and paraded before other inmates, which also violates the Convention Against Torture and Degrading Treatment. And the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture said Manning was subjected to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment in the excessive and prolonged isolation he was put in during the 8 months he was in Quantico. So, yes, it wasn't until there was a public outcry, including, I'm proud to say, a letter by 250 law professors to the Obama administration, really outraged at the treatment of Bradley Manning, that he was moved from Quantico Brig in Virginia to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where he is now reportedly no longer being tortured. He is not in solitary confinement anymore, but he is still facing life in prison.
Marjorie, we are out of time. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Marjorie Cohen, Professor of Law, Thomas Jefferson School of Law. The book that we've been talking about is The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production in downtown Milwaukee. Marjorie at the UWM Union this Thursday at 7:30. We'll return. News ahead.